now. Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight has been described as one of the most compelling storytellers in Australian journalism. Over his 30-plus year career, he's been a feature writer, investigative journalist and columnist, and has been widely awarded for his work, including a coveted Gold Walkley and Golden Quill Awards. He's rubbed shoulders with media moguls, gangland criminals and racing industry identities, all in pursuit, of course, of a good story and the truth. And tonight he shares some of those tales with us. It is my pleasure to welcome to Great Australian Lives, Andrew Rule.
It's a great pleasure to be here, and I didn't get lost getting here, so that's a great start.
Well, a lot of people have, so well done. Well done. Now, Cup Week.
Huge.
I've introduced you, of course, as a crime writer. Your passion, you're well known for true crime writing, but there is a big part of Andrew Rule that has the passion for the racehorse, and Cup Week's got to be cherry on top.
An unknown thing about me is that I'm probably the only Walkley Award-winning journalist to have ridden a winner.
I was going to bring that up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's good.
All over your interview.
I'm glad you confirmed it because I didn't know if it was actually true or not. So
it
there
is
you go.
True,
Who'd you ride?
I rode an obscure beast at a picnic meeting back in the early 70s. In fact, I rode for a couple of seasons at the picnics in East Gippsland, ordinary amateur rider, probably the worst in the area.
But you still did it, didn't
but
you?
But I was fairly heavy even then.
Right.
I think I had to lose
weight. You don't look like a jockey.
No, well, I've come from a family where there are several jockeys.
Right.
But we were from the bigger side of the family.
What is it about, I mean, as I said, you're a crime writer, everyone knows you for that, but this passion inside you for racehorses, where did that come from?
A liking for larceny, I think, racing and crime. No,
well,
just joking.
There is a marriage there.
It's interesting.
Mm.
There, as a friend of mine says, there are no boring people in racing. I think often written, because I tend to repeat myself, that there are many shrewd people in racing but no prudent ones.
Mm.
And that's...
That's a good point.
A lot of colourful characters. If you were prudent, you wouldn't do it, would you?
Yeah, that's right. Where did it come from? You said in the 70s you were riding.
I grew up with horses.
Yeah.
Grew up on a farm, rough little farm up in the bush, rough country, you know, literally rough country.
Gibson.
So we used horses to get around and round up stock. I occasionally rode to school and that sort of thing. I can remember riding at the age of 7, 6 miles as it was through the bush to get a vaccination.
On your own?
On my own.
I love it.
And back. So that's
I love it.
12-mile round trip.
How old did you say 6 years old?
I was 7.
Can you imagine that now?
I was 7 and probably, 8 months, 7.
Can you imagine that now?
No, he wouldn't let them cross the road.
If a kid turned up at the medical centre, tied up the horse out the front and walked in and said, "I'm here for my shot, please."
And he was a...
And then got back on the horse.
He was a bugger of a pony. He used to kick and... Anyway, so I can remember that. And when I was older, I went off to boarding school and that was okay. But after a couple of years, it was a drain on my parents financially.
Yeah.
I went to live with my uncle in Stratford in Victoria. Mm-hmm. Eastern Victoria, where I lived for about 3.5 years, and he was a horse trainer, a farmer, but he'd been a horse trainer and a very good jockey, and so were his sons. And I rode work with horses they trained, gallopers, and that's where I got the taste for the stories. And in fact, for Cup Week, I've written a story, and one of the stories about the cup came directly from my uncle, who is actually mentioned in this story.
Oh, really?
So it's really homage to him.
Oh, that's beautiful.
My late uncle, Eric Rule, known as Squib Rule, who was a...
always a nickname, isn't
Squib,
there?
Squib, yeah. Not because he was a squib, he was very brave.
Yeah.
But because he was very small from...
Right.
From when he was born.
Yeah.
I think he sort of infected me with it because he had all these great stories and he was a great all-round horseman and he was a great raconteur.
Now, speaking of horses, reissue of Winx. This is the authorised biography that you wrote about Winx. Now, if you don't know, if you're listening and don't know who Winx is, you must have been under a rock because, you know, champion racehorse.
Yep.
But you you wrote that originally and she'd had consecutive wins. Incredible. Yep. You had to rewrite it though, didn't you?
Well,
reissue it.
Reissue a new edition. So we published the hardback edition this time last year, or in fact a little earlier than this last year, just on the eve of her fourth Cox Plate. Mm. Now, I urged the publishers, I said, we must get this out before the fourth Cox Plate because racehorses go wrong. Yes. Everything goes wrong. But it didn't. Mm. So that meant that this year we had put out a new edition, the soft cover, with the complete, the fourth Cox Plate, plus all her other races since then.
Yes. I was going to say, how many
wins? And her retirement.
Right.
So
there's a lot to...
33 lot to... straight now. 33 straight, 37 total.
And what was she up to with the first edition?
27. Yeah. So... she raced on for several months and her
it
last...
just blew our minds, basically.
It was unbelievable. I mean, she is the modern Farlap, I think.
Wow, that's a big call.
It's a big call, because but I think it's valid.
There are other horses. There's Sunline, there's Maccabi Diva, Black
Kingston
Caviar.
Town.
There's some really big names, and Winx is, of course...
Tullock.
I want to know from you, why is she the modern Farlap and not Black Caviar, not Sunline, not Maccabi Diva?
Well, look, Black Caviar's unbelievable, but she's a sprinter. Mm. So really apples and oranges.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So that's a different thing. But, you know, I don't know that we'll ever see another horse win 25 straight. It could happen. Mm. And she was never defeated. Mm-hmm. So she was good from day dot. The others are more middle distance horses. But Winx was described to me by Chris Waller as being like Usain Bolt, but able, in Usain Bolt terms, able to win over,
100 metres.
Over 800.
Yes.
So she's actually a great sprinter, but she has the stamina to be a champion 2,000 metre horse.
And she's an all-rounder, our Winx.
Had they tried, there's little doubt in the mind of Waller or Hugh Bowman, who rode her, who are very considered, measured people, that she could have won, a Newmarket handicap over 1,200, a la the sort of thing that Black Caviar could do, or conceivably a Melbourne Cup over 3,200.
Incredible.
But Bowman points out, he said, if she won a Melbourne Cup, and she would, you probably wouldn't race her again. It'd stretch her too far.
That's it for her. She never went overseas either, did she?
No.
Do you know why?
The consecutive winning streak really... an end to it. I think the fact that they were kept doing it and doing
it. Feeling the pressure to keep going.
Pressure to keep going. There's big stakes here.
Yeah.
Why would you travel overseas with any horse, let alone a mare who might respond with hormones and things differently in different seasons, when you can race for bigger stakes here? They can come here. The aeroplanes are great. Yes. They run both ways. Yep. They can fly here.
Really?
Yeah. So this is the thing. I mean, this was their attitude.
Yeah.
And Waller said to me in a quiet moment once, If she'd missed a race, lost one,
yes,
and she wasn't injured and not sad, everything was good.
Yep.
Then he said, I would have loved to take her to America or Japan or France.
Yeah, okay. She seemed on face value to have such a dream. It was a dream. Once she got going, it was a dream run for Winx on face value. But you've investigated, you've spoken to everyone, all the connections.
I have.
Were there things going on behind the scenes, dramas that we weren't aware of?
There's two things that the public probably don't know much about. They're not secrets, but one was early in her career as a two-year-old, she was so smart as a youngster that despite her sort of gangly looks, she looked like a young netballer muscling up to, young weightlifters. Mm. But that was the look of her. And she showed enough that Waller thought they might use her in a golden slipper.
Right.
Now, as he admitted much later, had that happened, it would have been a very different story for her.
Mm.
It would have
very different
changed story. the trajectory a lot.
Yes.
But luckily or unluckily, it seemed like bad luck at the time, she got a hoof abscess. I'm holding my hand up like a hoof. And the
put
hoof,
your hoof down.
The hoof abscess, they thought it wasn't much, but then it got worse. And then they turned around. And in the end, he said, sorry, people, to the owners.
Yeah.
And I've got all his emails. He gave them all to me.
Wow.
We have to rest her for months. Now, she had months in the paddock, and in that time, she grew stronger, bigger, more robust. And that is what made Winx.
She matured.
She matured, and she got that chance that some horses don't get.
Mm.
And so she benefited from that long term. And once Waller realised how good she was, he looked after her absolutely brilliantly.
Mm.
There's no doubt about that. Sorry, the other thing that happened, she did get a
bone chip,
yeah. Small bone chip. It's sort of in the middle of her career.
Yes.
And between engagements, between preparations, they did an operation on the quiet.
Yeah.
They shipped her up to the Spelling Farm under a bodgy name.
Wow.
Just to keep everybody hose it
yes,
down with the media.
Yes, yes.
And they put her on a water walker thing, which yep. was a really expensive thing from Iceland or somewhere.
Yeah.
And she recovered brilliantly and faster than the vets thought she would.
Right.
And she came back better than ever. It was a great piece of horse husbandry and
yes,
veterinary work.
Yes.
And Chris Waller's skill.
Well, I was going to say, she's an incredible champion, but there's a lot to say for him too, isn't there?
Oh,
to
no
recognise.
No doubt.
What she is.
And this is not defamatory, but had Tommy Smith had her, or even Bart Cummings, or almost any of those old-timers, Jeff Murphy, they would have run her in everything. They would have put her in Melbourne Cups, and she, and then they put her in something else. Mm. And she might have won a Melbourne Cup, and then she might have not done it again.
Yeah.
But these fellows, some criticised it and said they kept her in cotton wool, but she went out and she won handicaps. She won the best weight for age races. She took on all sexes.
Yeah.
There was a great mare in America called Zenyatta by the same sire. Giant mare. Mm. Won 19 on end.
Wow.
Great. But she raced against mares and fillies.
Right.
And that's great, but it's not as great as Winx.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Chris Waller, he's got his own story, doesn't he? He started out sort of, not very well to do. It's his,
dead right.
his own personal story of, I wouldn't want to say rags to riches, but he's
nearly
done very well.
Dairy farmers, and I get this, I'm from the country, we milked Jersey cows and had a few sheep, we didn't realise how poor we were.
Mm.
And he was the same. So poor but honest people. But in New Zealand there's that tradition, as it is in East Gippsland a bit, of horses. Most farmers have a horse or two or know a bit about them.
Yep.
And a lot of them will breed a young one or buy one or race one. And
for fun?
For fun.
Just and to, also to try their hand?
Try their hand. And also they'll sell a young, if they can breed a bit better one, they'll sell it at sales. So it's always been, racing in New Zealand has always been linked to farming.
Mm.
And it's to some extent a better class of person, if you know what I mean. Probably a bit like Ireland, I suspect.
I thought you were going to say probably a bit like I am.
No, Ireland, not like I am. And Waller's family were good horse people all the way back and good dog people. They were shepherds and so on.
Yep.
And great stockmen. He uses that word. He said, my father and grandfather were great stockmen. They were good with cattle.
Yep.
They were good with whatever they... Mm. He said to me,
the blood.
It was a sin to lose a beast, to lose a farm animal.
Yeah.
And we looked after them well, and that's how he was brought up, with horses and cattle and dogs and the whole thing. He raised calves on the bucket when he was a kid, potted them, as we say.
Yep.
And that's how he bought his first car and all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
So he grew up working hard.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's a hard-working, hands-on man.
Hands-on guy.
Yeah.
Bright, but not particularly academic.
Right.
His mother was a school teacher, and he's highly intelligent, highly organised, highly motivated. He'd make a great sports coach in any discipline.
Yeah.
And that's what he sees himself as, a coach.
That's good.
He could have gone into farming, and he took on training.
Oh, God, he'd be thanking.
Yes.
Thanking his lucky stars. Now, did it take you a while to earn his trust? I mean, you turn up and say, I want to write a book. I mean, these people have got to trust you with this beautiful story.
That's right. Look, it was a walk-up start in a way, because it was they decided that, yes, a book would be done.
Right,
And
they already decided
they
decided
that I think their end of the book goes to, charities or whatever, horse welfare and jockey welfare and so on.
timely.
Timely, yeah. And look, and Waller is a genuine article about that.
Yeah. He's, is he?
Oh, yeah.
That's all,
he
I was going to ask you about that.
He's solid gold, really.
At the moment, given the recent investigation, whatever you want to call it, on ABC 7:30. Yeah. How do you feel about you're someone who's passionate about racing?
I am.
It is divisive.
It
this
is.
Issue.
Look, it's a matter of perceptions versus reality and logic. But of course, perceptions do matter because the perception is what's going to drive people to go to the races or stay away.
Mm. And for those listening right now who don't know what I'm talking about, this is, of course, revelations about the treatment of racehorses.
Ex-racehorses,
how they end up and what happens to them next. And that's been very divisive in the lead-up to the carnival.
And look, you know, it's only logical and sensible that not all ex-racehorses of either code and ex-greyhounds, that they can't all end up standing in a paddock somewhere until they're 28 and then go to heaven on a blanket.
Wearing a crown.
It doesn't happen like that. Mm. At some point in their life, whether they're 6 or 16 or 26, they will have to be euthanized.
Yes.
Now, that's reality.
Mm.
And it's always been a reality. We have far more racehorses bred than can ever be soaked up as, you know, riding school hacks or pony clubbers or trail riders.
Yes.
Many of them are not suitable for that.
Mm.
And in any case, there are far too many.
Mm.
So that's an issue. What the industry has to come to grips with is a realistic solution.
Mm.
And in my view, and I've written this in the newspapers, the only realistic one for them is probably to ensure that there can be an affordable service to euthanise horses.
Yes.
It's not the Chris Wallers and the trainers.
No.
It's not them. It's when the horse,
it's lesser horses. Yes.
I have done this. I've gave one to somebody to play polo with, and luckily it's a good polo pony.
Yes.
Now, what if that
if they're not?
What if that polo pony bucked somebody off and hurt somebody's teenage kid?
Mm.
Well, they'd have to get rid of it. Mm. Well, as it stands, to send them to a Echuca to the horse sale and then go to an abattoir is not a great look.
No.
If you just call in the euthanising people and they just give it the injection or shoot it, which is actually kinder, then it can be processed. It's not in fear, it's not in pain, and it was all done properly.
Yep.
That is what we owe all animals.
Mm.
And it's what we owe each other.
Yep. Well, stay with us. There's plenty more still to come on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. More with Andrew Rule when we return. Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Tonight we are celebrating the life and incredible career of Andrew Rule, journalist, author and now podcaster. Prolific podcaster now. You do a lot of it. Very popular podcasts of yours. Back in your childhood that we mentioned in the first segment, growing up in Gippsland, way before there were smartphones and you know, the 24-hour news cycle and
didn't have a telephone in the house when I was a little
boy.
That's what I understand. Nor a television.
Nor
electricity when I was young, very young. I can remember kerosene lamps.
Yeah.
I had a 1940s childhood in the 60s.
Yeah.
If you know.
Is that because you were living
Remotely, yeah.
Yeah.
And that all changed. By the time I went to secondary school, that had changed.
What were those days like in terms of
It seemed normal to me because we lived out.
Did you have friends that were living differently and
a little differently, but not much. Like we had friends in other remote areas that wasn't that different.
Right.
And we all had generators. You know, we had little two-stroke motors that ran power plants and all that. So, it wasn't that bad. It was okay. But we had pigs. We lived a vaguely peasant lifestyle. We had pigs that we fed the skim milk too from the dairy, and the cream was sold to the butter factory, and we had sheep and horses and cattle, and you know, if there was a kangaroo knocked over on the road or a wombat, we'd bring them home for the dogs and all that, tan the hides, all that sort of stuff.
So that I was going to ask you what you do for entertainment as a kid.
Read.
There's no radio, no TV. You
read
because Mum was big on reading, wasn't she?
My mother was a school teacher, a highly articulate and erudite woman.
Mm.
She can still do, you know, crosswords and things better than any of us in her late 80s. And she was she probably read a book a day most of her life.
Wow.
And
how would you have time?
Difficult.
There would be a lot of work to do.
She'd wedge it up in front of the sink.
Really?
She was a bit like that.
Yeah.
It's a bit like some people with their iPhones.
I was just about to say, I hope there's not a certain cartoonist listening right now.
Oh, well, that's okay.
Because, you know, the baby, you might have fallen out of the pram while mum was reading the book.
Easily. But she was very careful about safety, I have to say. She was very careful about not none of us being hurt, and in the end, none of us were.
Do you remember feeling neglected as mother was
reading? No, not really.
There you go.
Because you just get used to it. But we one thing she did was teach us to read at a very young age, and I can recall all cards being around the wall, you know, O-N-E-1, T-W-O-2, and I still can see the word for eight, E-I-G-H-T, eight, and reciting it at the dinner table.
Yes.
So by the time we got to school, we knew all that.
Yep.
And so I always had a bit of a head start on other kids.
And speaking of other kids, did you have siblings?
Two younger brothers.
Yeah, so you were the leader of the pack.
I was the oldest anyway.
did they share your love of reading and mum's?
Not as much, possibly. The middle brother is more scientific. Mum said I liked ideas and he liked things. Mm-hmm. You know, it was sort of
Different sides of the brain almost.
Different sides of the brain. Yeah. And he has got a scientific job.
Yep.
And my youngest brother's a bit of everything.
He can do all sides of the brain.
He can cartoon and draw and paint and build houses and fix cars.
Got one of everything.
Yeah, a little bit. Can't spell very well.
Yeah, okay. Now you, speaking of spelling, you won the essay comp at the Sale Agricultural Show.
Twice, back
to back. 2 years, back to, okay, 2 years in a row.
Sorry.
Prize was presented by the Gippsland Times.
It was.
Do you remember that? That must have been
$5 it was.
$5. Which, big then,
in
though.
1970. Yeah. 3 and 4 was, it was okay. You know, I mean, I think you could fill a car with fuel for $5.
Oh, yeah.
When I first got a car. So it was
Got a car, my Volkswagen Beetle, I think it was $23 or something to fill it.
I'm much older than
that. The other day I filled my car and it cost $100. $100.
I know, it's sad.
Nearly blew my head off my shoulders. Anyway, so you win the Sale Agricultural Show 2 years in a row, the writing essay competition.
Essay.
Was that the first time you'd put
written for money?
Yeah.
I think it got me in the door at the local paper.
The Gippsland Times.
And I went down and did a week work experience.
Yeah.
And they got me to write some captions, which I probably wrote in longhand.
Yeah.
And things like that. And I must have been a bit interested in it.
Yeah.
And I'd been a good student all the way through. I'd won scholarships and stuff.
Yeah.
But my final year, I didn't do that well in the exams. I think I was sort of nervous.
In year 12?
I'd got into a university, but I deferred it a year.
Is that RMIT?
It was actually Monash, but I did attend RMIT for a week. and then I decided I'd rather
now,
do something else.
Can you tell me why? Was there a clash in your class times?
I had to do journalism by correspondence.
Yes.
And I went down for the week you had to do before
you.
But the correspondence thing, I had to do classes in night school after work in Sale. And it was sort of pay night. And, of course, I was more interested in spending my pay than doing that. So I just learnt on the job in the end, which is a sad thing.
Do you know what, though? No disrespect to universities, and you learn a lot, but I honestly found, same thing, I did journalism, but I honestly found I learnt so much more when I got a job.
Yeah. I later went to uni.
Yeah.
I worked for a year at Sale on the Gibby Times. Then I went to Monash. Then I went to The Age and so on and so on.
Yeah. Do you remember what the first story was you got into the paper, into the Gippsland Times, actual proper story?
I can remember that there were only a few bylined ones. I didn't use bylines. And if you had to write it was so rare that
if you got
a byline in, you had to shout everybody in the office, and there were only four of us.
Yeah.
A milkshake. There's no drinking or smoking in the office.
Really?
They were very strict. And
were we typewriters then?
Oh, yes, indeedy.
Yeah.
And
sorry to interrupt you, but I'm very interested in this particular topic because a colleague of mine, Tony Jones, was the same in terms of he started on typewriters in the Channel 9 newsroom many years ago.
He did.
And he has a reputation for pretty much beating up the keyboard now.
Still do.
So when someone walks into your newsroom at the Herald Sun, are you in the corner bashing up the keyboard with with true. Great variety.
With two fingers.
Yes, yes, he's or the same. Bang, 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 bang,
two
bang, bang.
And maybe thumbs, yeah.
Right, there you go. You can't lose it, can you?
You can see the oldsters, yes. By the way, they type
yeah.
badly.
Incredible.
And all the kids type beautifully and flat.
And they're not looking and all.
It's very different.
Good for your biceps, though.
I've never got any better at it.
Haven't you?
No, I'm no better a typist now than I was when I was 20.
Haven't things changed, though, since you started as a cadet at the Gippsland Times and you're saying, you know, you're on a typewriter. Now, most newspapers are consumed online.
Yeah.
You're doing podcasts. Yeah. There's even video being shot for online. A
true.
Lot. You know,
a
it's
lot
very
of that.
It's yep. very important to online papers to have video content as well. It's almost unrecognisable now, isn't it?
It is. But its storytelling hasn't altered.
Mm.
And, you know, I'd listen to my family were good storytellers, many of them.
Mm.
And I'd really that art hasn't changed. And, you know, knowing what works.
The power
knowing
of the
how
written
to shape
word
a story.
You can't
yeah.
change, can you? I mean,
written and spoken, I think.
Yeah.
Knowing how to shape a story.
Yes.
And, you know, my uncles, they were my dad's half-brothers, and one had been a jockey and one was a – they were both farmers, but one had been a very good buck-jump rider and bare-knuckle fighter and all that, tough guys, and not terribly well-educated, but could they tell stories?
Yeah.
They were funny men.
Yeah.
And they collected stories and they'd mimic people.
Yeah.
They'd mimic accents. Or something.
Yes.
And they mimicked their neighbours. And they were just funny people.
They must be proud of you now.
Yes. Well, there's not many of them left. But, yeah, I suppose so. But, yeah. You know, we're all – I'm a grandfather myself now, so there's not many of those old family members around, sadly.
Do you remember – I mean, you ended up at the age – you went to the age in your early career – do you remember what your first big investigative story was, big front page or?
Yeah, look, they shunted me around. I did courts. I did the farming agricultural round.
Of course.
A lot of sport.
Yep.
They took one look at me, I think, and thought, oh, he looks a bit rough.
Country boy.
And I was never sent to, not that I cared, but I was never sent up to Spring Street to do
politics,
state rounds or anything. Mm. But I oscillated between largely sport and crime, or sport and courts and crime.
How'd you feel about sport?
I didn't really know much about it. Mm. We weren't a family that sort of followed footy much. Mm. Dad had played footy and cricket. But Mum was a great tennis player as a girl, but didn't care. I think she played country week tennis.
Yeah. Yeah.
She can still play tennis.
Good on
but
her.
She didn't.
On your mum.
She didn't care about it.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a big thing for her. So we weren't sort of brought up to revere sport.
So you were thrown in the deep end a little bit, having to learn on your feet.
But basically, I just sort of. But writing about it is not playing it.
Yes, oh, no.
You know, some of the best sports writers I've ever seen were probably hopeless at playing the game.
Well, again, Tony Jones tells me he's a shocking footy player.
Oh yeah, oh, no, yeah. I'm probably in there with Tony.
Yeah.
I was never much. Both my boys are, all my kids. Better at sport than I was.
So you get a taste for the crime round, which is now what you are renowned for.
Yeah.
Did that first taste ignite something within you, do you think?
I think what it told me is that you could write stories that mattered to people because they were about life and death, winning and losing, right and wrong, the basic visceral things that go to the heart of being human.
Yes.
And so when Shakespeare writes stuff or the ancient Greeks write stuff, it is about life and death and right and wrong and whether, you know, you're going to kill your father. And that's, you know, they're not writing about cardboard boxes.
Yes.
Policy, you know. So I found that sort of interesting because I could write the sort of thing that I'd want to read. And I was greatly probably influenced by a book called In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, which was the first of its type. It was the technique of the novel used in a real crime situation.
Do you remember, Andrew, and for those tuning in just at the moment, we're speaking with Andrew Rule, renowned crime writer and author. Do you remember, Andrew, the first sort of big crime that you went to in Melbourne, being confronted, that feeling that you might not necessarily feel now?
The things I remember being in court at Brunswick when they brought all the bad guys out of Pentridge because Chopper Reed had been stabbed. And that's a scene you've seen in the movie.
Yes,
but this was
but
the real thing.
You remember the real
version.
I
was there, and there was this young guy called Chopper Reed who was sort of just becoming known.
Yep.
And he had his ears were sort of cut off, and they had all these very bad dudes that were giving evidence or not giving evidence or telling lies. And they had there was the biggest detectives you've ever seen. Honestly, it was a guy called Gary Skipper. He must have weighed 20 stone. He was 6 foot six. And they all had shooters in court.
Wow.
And there was a cop with a shotgun on the roof. And it was just like something out of a movie.
Incredible.
And I can remember that vividly. And that was it was very sort of interesting. And that was the start of my interest in the sort of Chopper Reed phenomenon.
Yeah. Of whom you know, later had a hand on. In making very well known.
John Sylvester himself. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And that was probably the first memory you have of the big...
I remember that. Look, I worked for The Age and they were notoriously dull newspaper in those days. Had it been a dull newspaper nearly all of its time, apart from, say, 10 years when Graham Perkin edited it. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult to get a crime story on the front of The Age unless it was, you know, a Supreme Court judge has been shot in court.
Right.
I mean, that front page... and crime didn't mix on The Age. Mm. Whereas my colleagues, my mates that worked on the
Herald Sun.
the little paper, the Sun and on the Herald,
yep.
They, you know, meet and drink, they would have 20 front page leads a year and at least. That's spacious, let alone other stories on the front and on page 3 and page 5 and 7. You know, they dominated the paper. In a way that we never did. So I never really got to exercise. I never got a big run in, except occasionally. And the biggest story I wrote at police rounds was a racing piece. I wrote a racing feature.
How it turns out. Well, stay with us. I'm Laura Turner and you're listening to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. And up next we'll find much more about Andrew Rule's career from crime writer to podcaster. Great to have your company on Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Tonight we're celebrating the life and work of writer, journalist and now podcaster Andrew Rule. The reissue of Andrew's book Winks, of course, the champion racehorse, the authorised biography is in stores, of course, for Melbourne Cup Week. If people listening want to know where to find it, all good bookstores?
All good bookshops and possibly some bad ones.
Okay, all of them then. Everyone wants
I'm hoping so. I'm told that in a time when books are not selling that well across the board, that this one, this new edition has been reprinted already. So there must be some demand for it.
And is it glued together properly?
It is, and you seem to know something.
I refer to that because if you followed Andrew's career, you would know, was it The Underbelly series?
It was the first... Chopper book.
Oh, the first Chopper book.
Is that what you're referring to? About glue?
Yes, that you wrote with John Sylvester, Sly of the Underworld, as we also know him.
Yep.
And that book fell apart.
It did. Look, John and I...
But it helped in the end, didn't it?
It did. As I say to people, you can't learn this stuff at doing a Harvard MBA. What you've got to do is self-publish a book, send it off to a printer having taken out a mortgage to pay the printing bill, which is what we did, and then it's not glued together properly by your cheap printer with the cheap glue and the cheap machinery and the cheap paper, and all the leaves start to fall out of the book, which is sad because some people complained, but most people just went out and bought another one.
Because they might have thought they had a one-off that was bad.
So they went and it wasn't an expensive book.
So your sales go through the roof, you climb the bestseller list.
And here's the other tip. If you're dealing in this sort of stuff, it's a dodgy clientele, some of them that want it. Some are just very respectable, nice people. And others are, you know, a bit shonky. And they're the sort of people that booksellers suspect of being shoplifters. And so the booksellers then put these books... in their news agents and so on, up on the counter next to the till where they can see them.
And everyone else can see it.
And that means they sell them because they're right there under their
eye.
So
I'm starting a new career as a crime writer. You're selling books.
They tell me that did help.
By default.
By default.
But that book was...
It was
incredible.
A smash hit. And we reprinted it like 30 times over many years.
There's a really good story behind how that happened, isn't there, in terms of... chopper
yeah.
approaching you?
Well, it's John's story, but I'll steal it. John Sylvester,
yeah.
spelt with an I. Everybody spells it with a Y, like the cat. But
as opposed to Dennis with one N, but we'll come to that later.
Yes, true. He goes into Pentridge. He somehow got into Pentridge, into H Division back in the mm. day. This is probably very late 80s, mm. to interview this Chopper Reed. And he's shown into a room and here he is, sitting at a desk. There's no thick glass panel, none of that. And then the screw, that is the officer, steps outside and there's John, skinny little John Sylvester, yeah. with this man mountain. And Chopper grabs John's hand and I'm demonstrating this to the microphone,
yes.
which is no use at all.
No.
And he pulls John's hand over to his skull, meaning Chopper's skull. And he says, yeah. feel that hole there? And John says, yes. He said, that's where the ice pick went in.
Oh, my God.
And that's the start of their conversation.
Yeah.
And Chopper told John a lot of stuff and John wrote a story, which is very interesting. But John liked the story, as he says. The editor liked the story. The readers liked the story.
Mm.
Chopper didn't mind the story, but he said the parole board hated the story and got an extra 6 months.
Oh, so and that's what led to the letters, isn't it?
The next bit of it is Chopper said, look, I want a book written. He was never motivated by greed necessarily. Mm. I mean, he liked money, but
maybe
he wanted notoriety.
Yeah.
And he saw early. Chopper was a keen reader. Mm. He'd read a lot in jail, mm. like some of those guys do.
Mm.
And he had a very high verbal IQ,
mm-hmm.
which is people shake their heads at this. He reminded me in some ways of Ali, Muhammad Ali.
Okay.
Chopper could do rhyming couplets. He could make up poetry that worked.
Yep.
He was sort of a very funny guy in his way.
Mm. Hilarious.
And he said, look, I'm, there's Squizzy Taylor, Ned Kelly, Squizzy Taylor, and now there's me. And he saw that. He saw that he could do it.
Right.
But he knew that the only way to do it was through being written about.
Notoriety.
And so he sort of said, I want a book written. And John said, look, well, you've got to get a bit of paper and a pencil, write your own. And next thing, in the letterbox at the old Herald's, at the Herald and the Sun office,
yes,
as it was,
yes.
comes an envelope addressed to John Sylvester in very dodgy, childish handwriting from box 114 Coburg, Pentridge.
Yeah.
And it's got two pages of handwritten stuff. Dear John. And Sly Johnny showed me this and said, look at this stuff. It's hilarious. And then next day is another one. Next day is another one. And John and I had started to write a book together.
Yes.
And we'd written one page about something else.
Which is now in the rubbish
bin.
And
we suddenly said, this is better.
Yeah.
So we took this rough stuff.
Yeah.
And it was very rough.
Yeah.
But at heart it was funny and it was bleak.
Yep.
And macabre.
Yep.
And we took it and we shuffled it on the floor of a room.
Yep.
And we put early life, middle life, crimes, what I did, crimes, what I didn't do.
Yeah.
And we shuffled
apparently.
Them into sort of chapters. And then we sat down and John went through and typed them in his very bad typing, into the system, which was the big, ugly old system that we first started with in newspapers.
Yep.
And then I would sit there late at night after subbing all, and I would go through what John had done and polish it up more and add stuff and subtract stuff. And by the end of this process, we had turned these letters
from
into
Pentridge.
A book.
Yeah, incredible.
And we called that initial book, it was going to be called Letters from Inside.
Yep.
And in the end, we just call it Chopper from the Inside.
Yep.
And that became a cult hit.
Mm.
And one of the reasons it did, I think, is that the Australian cricket team, who are probably not big on Shakespeare and stuff, they all had a copy of it because they got, how good's this? And they were filmed getting off the plane in, London, Heathrow, and they're all waving a Chopper book.
Ah.
And they had one. So it just was a massive hit, and then they fell apart and people bought more of them.
Was that intentional?
No, it wasn't. We were distressed.
You'd upped the quality of the glue by then. They were well-read books.
They were well-read.
Now, your first true crime book was Cuckoo, which was a huge success. And for those who don't know, the story of Raymond Edmonds, convicted rapist and double murderer, otherwise known as Mr. Stinky.
Yes.
And that is because of the work he did, wasn't it? He had a terrible stink about him.
They think... Probably he mostly was a share farmer and he milked cows.
Mm.
Now, when you milk cows, which I've done a little bit, you do get that smell of the sort of stale milk and the sort of greasy smell. Mm. And also there's the chemicals you use to clean the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And the two smells are fairly pungent.
Mm.
And it's thought that maybe sometimes he had that smell on him because it does get into your skin.
Mm.
But other people said, look, when people are these rape victims were terrified and their senses are heightened, and any smell or anything about that person, that attacker, would be really dominant.
Yes.
And really they would remember it clearly. Mm. And that might have also skewed their memories.
Right.
It was actually probably more useful to say he had bare feet and he carried a large butcher's knife.
Because
and
you can't
he had reddish
argue
hair.
That. Yeah.
Because they're things that are actually identifying characteristics.
Yes.
The smell was always a little bit, and not all people reported it.
Yes.
And in the end, it was exaggerated by us in the media.
Right.
In fact, I know
it's
the guy.
It's an easy point to argue as a defence lawyer, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And a sub wrote a headline. They said, what are we going to call this guy? They didn't know who it was.
Mm.
They were looking for an unknown
Mr.
attacker.
Mr. Stinky.
And they said, can we call him, Mr. This, Mr. That, Mr. Stinky? It fitted the gap.
That's often how it happens.
The headline count, yeah. And that's how he got the name. And that sort of has altered the perception of him.
Yeah.
A very ordinary, dull, uninteresting man.
Raymond Edmonds. These people, aren't they?
There's nothing interesting about him, but it was his crimes had such an effect on a community.
Mm.
That's interesting.
Mm.
So the book I wrote almost had him out of the frame.
Yep.
He almost didn't see him in the book. And my nephew is currently working on a script for a TV series. And my suggestion for that is he's not in shot. This guy, you don't see him. You only see the girl that he first married, the kids, the people that he terrorised, whatever. All the people around him, not him. Because he's about as interesting as a Mack truck that runs off the road.
Yeah, if you focus just on him, it would get...
Yeah, he's
fairly dull.
Well, also repellent.
Mm.
Who wants to watch something about unless it's a brilliant work of art?
Yes.
Who wants to watch something about a multiple rapist? They're not that interesting.
Speaking of which, I can imagine with every true crime book that you've written and every article to some extent, it's true stuff, obviously. So you even on that first book, you would have to be aware, and I'm sure you still are whenever you write something like this, of how respectful you've got to be to not just the truth and the facts, but the context and the people, the family members left behind who will be watching. Is that something that you find particularly difficult? Or if not just difficult, but you feel that onus on you?
You do, and look... It always does worry me, and sometimes when people get back to you about a story or something, you've got this terror that they're going to burst into tears and say, what have you done?
Yes.
And it's always a relief when they say, you got that right.
Yes.
You've done a great job, and we were really worried, but you got it right. And that, I find, the highest form of praise.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's always really gutting when somebody says, no, you know.
Yeah, and you carry that with you, don't you?
Usually the main players, you don't get it wrong.
Yep.
It's the peripheral.
Yep.
You somehow insulted Auntie Mary or somebody on the way past.
Yep.
And you can do that easily in our business. And we have to be careful of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when there's so many players involved. And with humans, they all have a different opinion of what happened. So you've got to stand in the middle.
Tell me about it.
You've got to stand in the middle and get them all right.
Humans are the worst witnesses.
Yeah.
And in that first book I wrote, which led to me doing stuff with John Sylvester because he saw that I could write a book, which was something people didn't really do much of.
Yep.
You know, young working journos weren't writing books. And I did one, and it was a reasonably polished bit of work. And, you know, my great friend and mentor, Liz Carline, had read the manuscript for me and made suggestions. And, you know, my mother read it and made suggestions. So we'd sort of polished it up pretty well. Mm. And it was, this is Cuckoo.
Yep.
And I really, you know, I think one critic very kindly compared it with In Cold Blood, which was a bit like comparing me with Gary Ablett. You know, it's not as a footballer.
Oh, you'll take it.
I'll take it, but it's an exaggeration. But it did have a bit of that tone.
Mm.
Sort of a creepy story from a place you've never heard of, you know, mm-hmm. in a way.
Beautiful. Well, do not go anywhere. There is plenty more still to come with Andrew Rule when we return. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au for more information. Tonight, we are celebrating the life of Gold Walkley Award winner Andrew Rule, writer, journalist and podcaster, a word that's become very popular in the last few years, hasn't it? And
it has.
You started podcasting a little while ago, and I've got to say, you're right up near the top of the new podcast rankings. Your Life and Crimes podcasts are enormously popular.
Well, it is. And I have to say, it wasn't my idea. I didn't particularly want to do it. I didn't really know what it was.
Well, someone doing newspapers all these years and writing
peas
books.
In it. Yeah.
it's a new thing. Of course you're going to be...
But yeah, and it was people at the Herald Sun suggested doing it, notably Nick Papps that runs a Sunday paper,
yep.
but backed by Peter Blunden, who's the big boss and so on, and Damon Johnson thought it was a good idea. And they all said, yeah, do this. So I'm wondering there, we've got a very good producer there, a guy called John Burton, who is a very smart guy. And he was sort of able to lead me through it. And we sat in a little funny little, not a beautiful studio like this, we had this funny little room where you could hear people talking outside. And it was very uncomfortable. And we churn out these things, and mostly at the start I could just talk off the top.
Yeah.
But of course, once the demand hit and they said, you've got to do another one this week, another one, I'd have to sort of do my homework and dredge up stories that I'd written years ago. And and I can't actually remember everything I've written, funnily enough.
Yeah, of course. Well, you've written that much.
So it's become quite part of my working week to do one or two podcasts.
A week.
Because you need to build up a bank of them. Sometimes I'll do the odd one about, say, racing or something, but mostly about crime, essentially.
But people love listening. People love hearing the inside story, you know.
They do.
It's fascinating, especially for you. You've been and covered some of the biggest, most fascinating cases in Victoria.
I have. Yeah,
people want to know, wonder what that person was really like, what really happened.
I get a lot of feedback from it, and I am genuinely, this is not false humility, I just didn't realise there was such an appetite for it.
Especially in Melbourne, though.
In Melbourne,
we do. Crime's always on the front page.
Look, I brought the train in this morning, and I think looking around in that very crowded train, you've got a lot of people commuting who want to blank out the other commuters, and there's no room to read a newspaper, even if people were reading them, which many of them don't. And if they're not reading a book, they're listening to something. Now, increasingly...
Yes.
I think an alternative to radio, live radio, is the podcast.
Yeah.
And I think it's a vote for commuters amusing themselves.
Absolutely.
Filling in the commute.
I live an hour out or 40 minutes out of Melbourne and get the V line into Docklands.
Yeah.
And I do the same thing, podcasts all the way.
It fits the gap, doesn't it?
It's perfect.
Half-hour podcast sort of fills that thing.
And you feel like you're learning something, but you're also relaxing at the same time. And yours, obviously, are proving extremely popular.
Yeah, and I don't think I'm particularly good at it, but I just think it hits the spot.
I think you are.
And I think I'm well-produced.
You've got a good voice.
Well, I don't know about that. No one's accused me of that. but it sounds like a rusty gate hinge, I reckon.
No. And people love a sort of gravelly, mature voice. And
a gravelly, mature voice, that's right.
Anyway, they're very, very popular. And I'm sure that, you know, even just a few years ago, you would not have foreseen that is the chapter, or a chapter of your career.
Never. And I would have foreseen it for John Sylvester. Years ago, I said to him, Johnny, you know, one day I should be producing you on television, stories. He is a great raconteur.
Yes.
He's a natural raconteur, but he's also, as well as being natural, he sort of studies it a bit and he knows how to deliver lines.
Certainly. And when you hear him on 3RW in the morning,
he
delivers things beautifully.
He's all over it.
With the tongue in his cheek.
And look, he was good at that in our 20s when none of us could even speak at our own 21st.
Right.
John could, you know, hold the floor for half an
hour.
Tell
a story.
He's really good at it.
Yeah.
And it's probably what he's, you know, at an age where he could be a grandfather. He's hitting his straps as a raconteur on radio and probably now television and so on.
Do you know what I just thought? Do you know what I think probably helps podcasts as well? In this is completely my theory, but in this day and age of our attention spans becoming shorter because of social media and flicking through your phone, I find it difficult now to get through an article that's in front of me because you go, and look away. But a podcast you just put on in your ears and I think it takes less mental capability to digest.
I think we've told each other stories since we were sitting around
we've
in caves.
We've always been listening.
How we caught the saber-toothed tiger or whatever. And we've all, as little kids, Les Carline said to me, he said, every little child will sit there and say, and then what happened? What happened next? And don't they? And it's a human thing.
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
and
absolutely.
My little grandkids, that's all they want to do is get you to tell them, if it's not actually playing with a toy, is to tell them a story.
Now, speaking of which, your little grandkids, you mentioned that John's a grandfather, but...
Oh, no, sorry, John is not.
Sorry.
He's old enough to be
He's an old enough
he
to be
He looks like
grandfather.
A grandfather.
I hope he's not listening.
You won't mind.
You are a grandfather already, but you've got two more.
I was married very young.
Grandchildren on the way. Imagine being a grandfather in your 40s. Incredible.
Yes.
What a bank of stories you have to tell your grandchildren, though.
I do. They won't believe them, some of them. I'll say, you did what? You rode a horse where?
But even the crime stuff, incredible to be able to tell your grandchildren.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I've never sort of really spoken a lot about it to my kids or anything. There was a time when I was mostly worried about, you know, getting writs from lawyers more than danger.
Yep.
But there have been times when I've yelled at the kids, my own kids, when they were growing up and said, don't just open the door. Don't just go to the door when somebody knocks and open it because you don't know who it is.
Yes.
And I remember yelling very loudly at one of my children, so loudly the neighbours heard me because I was frantic about it, because there must have been something going on.
Mm. But you're on a story that was...
Yeah, something. And look, there's times, you know, I'd pull blinds and be a bit cagey. And
But there's good reason. Yeah. I mean, your coverage...
In the past.
We won't go into it, but the coverage of the Tanner case was one.
Was one, no
Dennis
doubt about
Tanner,
it.
Who was named but not... prosecuted
not charged.
Exactly.
The coroner called the shooting to death of his sister-in-law.
Yes.
The coroner.
It was long seen as a suicide, but in the end,
So that was a story that was interesting because it involved, in this case, a serving policeman. Mm. He had friends and relatives who were serving policemen.
Mm.
And they do make me nervous. The idea of a police officer with a lot to lose, I find far more chilling than the average crook. Because the average crook is probably not going to...
Taking on power.
There's no upside for them.
Mm. Andrew, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you.
Likewise.
And of course, if you've been listening and you have a passion for horse racing, Andrew's book, Winx, the Authorised Biography, is out in all good and bad bookstores. If you love our podcast, of course... Subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast. If you love Andrew's podcast, of course, subscribe to Life and Crimes. And don't forget to join me the same time next week when we celebrate another Great Australian Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.